Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. Appropriately enough, my name is Michael Cutler. I am your host. For those of you familiar with me, you know that I'm a retired senior special agent with what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service. And ever since the attacks of 9/11, I decided that it was important to provide my perspectives on the issues, especially from the immigration perspective, that left us vulnerable back then. And I fear continue to leave us vulnerable today and impact so many other aspects of the United States that are of concern or should be of concern to all Americans, especially the politicians. It's remarkable that we've had two debates thus far, yet the word immigration has yet to be uttered. Remarkable set of circumstances. If you want to learn more about me, not familiar with me, please go to a couple of websites. Get out your pen and pencil, folks. I have my own personal website, michaelcutler.net. That's one word, michaelcutler.net, michaelcutler.net. Also, talkborder.com. That's one word, talkborder, where we're doing videos and commentaries on, again, aspects of the immigration crisis that have such a profound impact on so many aspects of the United States today. And finally, and for a number of years now, I'm very pleased and proud to be associated with a wonderful organization, Californians for Population Stabilization. They are located in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara, California. I've had the unique privilege of visiting with them a number of times. I made some great friends out there. I've been working with them for years, writing commentaries for them along with other folks. And in fact, my most recent commentary is up on their website today, where I talked about how Mayor Bloomberg of New York City is jumping up and down demanding that trespassers at housing developments in the Bronx be prosecuted, but then on the other hand, apparently has no concern whatsoever about illegal aliens trespassing into the United States. Thorough disconnect. Hope you like that article. Hope you visit their website. It's capsweb.org, C-A-P-S, capsweb.org. You know, from time to time, I do my best to try to provide unique guests on my program. And this evening, I have an amazing guest. His name is Claude Berube. And or Berube, rather. I'm getting it sideways, I'm sure. He'll correct me. But he has an amazing background. He's currently an instructor at the Naval Academy at Annapolis. He's a reserve officer in the United States Navy, author of several books, one of which is out there right now. Has an amazing background, amazing perspective. I have to thank my friend Charles Heller, who has his own program at Liberty Watch that broadcasts from Arizona on Sundays. He connected me with Claude, and so without further ado, Claude, welcome to my program. I wish you, as my listeners out there, a very happy Friday. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Mike. I appreciate it. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
You have an amazing background. Am I getting your name almost right? Berube, is that the way we pronounce
Berube,
that?
Berube, that's it. It depends where you're from in the country, but Berube is generally it in from the Northeast. Yeah.
Okay, well, that will work. I can only imagine what some of the more exotic pronunciations might be like.
Well, there was actually a hockey player. Yeah, there was a hockey player for the Washington Capitals for many years, Craig Berube. And I think he was originally from Canada as well, and pronounced it Berube. So,
did you correct him?
Not once, you know, but I never met him on the hockey rink once. So had we met, then maybe.
And you know what's so great about America? And I keep making the point because everyone likes to say that you're being xenophobic if you want immigration laws enforced, and nothing could be further from the truth. Is that in fact, as Americans, no matter what our race, religion, ethnicity, at the end of the day, we're all Americans. And that's the one thing that should really be uniting all citizens of this great country, don't you think?
I agree. In fact, it's funny. When I was a kid, my mother was a state legislator for many years up in New England. And I remember my family being interviewed when I was probably 8 years old. And we were from a French-Canadian family. You know, my grandparents were all from French-speaking Canada. And we were being interviewed for this documentary, and I distinctly remember the interviewer asking all of us questions, and then they turned to me, you know, all of 8 or 9 years old, and they said, well, what's it like to be a Franco-American? I said, well, I don't know. I'm an American. And I could see, you know, I could see a few people cringe with that thought, but I was like, well, you know, I'm an American, and that's how I've always felt, and I've been very fortunate to have French-Canadian ancestry, but I'm American like everybody else.
Well, that's right. And, you know, people will this business about hyphenation, I think we've really hyphenated America. I happen to be Jewish. I don't consider myself a Jewish American, but an American Jew. And I think that the important difference is that first and foremost, we have to remember that it's this great country that provided so many opportunities for us, and why it's so important that not only the defense of this country being the responsibility of the men and women in the military, and I certainly thank you for your amazing service, but it's a responsibility, a mantle that all Americans must pick up to protect this country one way or the other. And, of course, the best part of that, or one of the biggest parts, is to take citizenship responsibly, become educated about the issues, not only vote in every election, which should go without saying, but to also develop a relationship, whether we like them or not, with our elected representatives. You know, I like to make the comparison that when we go into a restaurant, we're generally very specific about the food that we want to eat and the way that we want it prepared. I've never seen anybody walk into a restaurant and say to some guy, throw some crap on the plate, I'll eat it, I don't care what it is. And we shouldn't be any less specific with making our desires, our concerns, and if need be, our demands known to those who are paid to, in fact, represent us.
Yeah, and I would also add, as part of education, I can't think of many more important courses that a student can take than a basic civics or American government course. In fact, at the United States Naval Academy, as at West Point, all of our students are required to take a basic American government course because toward the end, when they are commissioned officers, they're sworn to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. So it's important for them to be able to at least have read the Constitution and have taken a semester learning about what it means and its history, its historical development.
What a unique thought to actually read the Constitution. You know, I remember a number of years ago, the students at Columbia University thought they would do a little experiment, and I have my issues with some of the folks at Columbia. I've been at their Graduate School of Journalism, where I've participated in debates as well as at their law school. But this was an interesting experiment. They took the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, Bill of Rights, typed it by hand, put it on a clipboard as though it was a petition, and asked passers-by if they'd be willing to sign it. And very few people recognized it for what it was. Some people apparently thought it was the Communist Manifesto, by the way. Can you imagine?
Or probably the 1936 Soviet Constitution.
Probably,
you know,
so.
That was my minor in college, was Soviet studies, and I just remember reading the old Soviet constitutions and some of the things that were in there. You know, an educated population is best for the governance of the United States.
Well, and James Madison and the other founding fathers felt so strongly about it. And the other point that's so important to make is, and I like to talk about the First Amendment, everyone immediately rattles off almost reflexively by rote, First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of press. There's two more, though. The right to seek redress of grievances. And there was a wonderful radio talk show host no longer with us who used to say, if you ain't mad, you ain't paying attention. So certainly there are grievances to be found. And the other one, the right to peaceably assemble. The idea being that debate, discourse, disagreement is as American as apple pie. And rather than vilify those fellow Americans of ours that we may disagree with, maybe it would be a good idea, instead of talking at one another, to really speak with one another and see if we could arrive at some common ground. If they talk about Congress being dysfunctional and at each other's throat, unfortunately, all too many Americans have gotten that way, and I don't think that most TV news programs do much to foster meaningful conversation or dialogue either. Any argument?
Sure, but we have to remember historically we've sort of always been at odds, even going back to the summer of 1787 in the Constitutional Convention, and the ensuing everybody reads the Federalist Papers, but in my class when I did teach American government, I had them read not only several of the Federalist Papers, but I had them read the countering arguments from the Anti-Federalist Papers, which are arguably far less read today than they were, but it just goes to show that there was this ongoing debate for several months as they were debating this newly proposed Constitution, and debate is healthy.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, back in high school, college, I was on the debating teams. My degree was in communications, arts, and sciences, even though I started out as an engineering major. I like to tell people I have a BA and BS, but you don't really know your side of the argument better than when you have to defend it. And, in fact, most of my coaches, when we did debate, would have us prepare for either side of the same argument, you know, but from both perspectives, and we wouldn't be told until perhaps 15 minutes before the actual debate session which side we were going to be on, so that we really had to be intimately aware not only of the side that we may have personally favored, but the other side as well. And I think that's so important to always remember, that there are two sides to a coin, two sides to a debate. And this idea of black and white, you know, you watch TV today, and it seems as though what you witness all too often are food fights. My mother, may she rest in peace, didn't have the benefit of a formal education, but as you well know, and I'm sure you'll agree, there can be a big difference between being educated and being inherently intelligent, and my folks who didn't have the educations were very smart people. And my mom used to say to me that it was pointless to try to win an argument with an idiot, but unfortunately, all too many times I would walk into a TV studio and unfortunately felt that that was exactly what I was about to do. So,
no, I absolutely agree with you. In fact, you know, I think of my parents as well, neither of whom went to college, but were probably two of the best read people I knew. And, you know, you're absolutely right. Being educated isn't necessarily a formalized degree, and I say that. You know, I have a couple of master's degrees. I'm working on my PhD. But, you know, I tell my students, even my the freshmen or the plebes, as we call them, that that doesn't make me smarter than them. It just makes me gives me a little bit more experience and a little better read. But they're going to be at that point in their careers in the not-so-distant future.
Yeah, and critical thinking skills are among the most valuable that we can cultivate and really value.
Absolutely, and that's I've tried to do that. I've been at the Naval Academy now 7 years, currently teaching naval history, but prior to that I was in the political science department. So I always went into the class trying to ask more questions than I would answer for the midshipmen, because I wanted to try to elicit responses from them. I didn't want them to feel intimidated. I knew what it was like going through college and my first grad school. When I knew what the teacher or the professor thought, and I didn't want to counter them too much. You know how the trepidation some students feel about that.
Yep.
So I always felt that my job going into the classroom was not to teach the midshipmen what to think. It was to teach them how to think.
Well, you know, Einstein said that what was more important than facts was concepts. And, you know, one of the great questions I love to ask people, and here's a good one to think about, what is the most valuable return that we have gotten for all of the space probes that we've sent out into the solar system and, in the case of Voyager, beyond? And the most valuable has been the questions, because the more we know, the more we are able to then pose the next set of questions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the beginning of the learning process. I think it was JFK who said, you judge a person not only by the answers they give, but more importantly by the questions that they ask. So it's kind of the Socratic method. And being Jewish, you know, they say the Jews answer questions with another question anyway. So I guess I'm guilty of that as well. You have such an amazing background. Why don't I let you tell my listeners out there a little bit about your amazing background? You're truly quite an accomplished American, one who has served our country so well and continue to, and I, again, thank you for your service. But I'd like the folks out there to know a little bit about you, so why don't you tell us who you are and what you're doing?
Sure, and I should probably preface it with, I appreciate the kind words, but I don't see my life as any more amazing than anybody else. I think we all have different paths. And I certainly known a lot of folks in the military who have truly been amazing. So I'll defer the amazing part to them, but I've had kind of a fun career. I've worked on Capitol Hill for a couple of senators, and just as a standard disclaimer, since I'm currently on active duty, that anything I express tonight or any ideas are my own and not those of the Naval Academy or the Navy. But I worked for senators from both parties, had an opportunity to learn both sides. I've worked on political campaigns way back in the day. I've had the opportunity to serve twice overseas as a recalled reservist, once in Europe and another time deployed with Expeditionary Strike Group 5 to the Persian Gulf. And on the way, we got to do some humanitarian relief operations off Sumatra during the tsunami of late 2004, and then later did some piracy operations off Somalia. I've also worked for the Office of Naval Intelligence as a civilian. That was several years ago now. And since then, I have been with the Naval Academy teaching.
That's
and
amazing.
I've written a few books. So.
And by the way, when we get to the books, I want you to tell my listeners out there about the books, and maybe you can make a couple of
sure.
bucks out of the deal and sell some of those books. I'm sure they'd love to
sure.
read it. I'm going to have to get my hands on your book as well. But I just want to remind you that Capitol Hill was built on swamp. So did it ever seem appropriate to you?
Because I'm currently on active duty, I couldn't possibly comment on that. And that's, you know what, I will say that's something important for your listeners who may not be aware that there is a reason why the military are really restricted from commenting on political issues, as I'm sure you're well aware.
Yes.
There is a necessary civilian military divide, and
yep.
that we take our orders from the civilian policymakers. So we actually have directives, and they're usually repeated every couple of years during an election season. In fact, there was a DOD directive, it's Department of Defense directive, not about, I guess, about 4 or 5 months ago now, that really outlined what military personnel could and could not do during an election season.
Mm-hmm.
So I would encourage your listeners that if they're interested, it's a DOD directive, and I don't have the number off the top of my head, but you can just see military personnel in elections. So there are certain things, like we can actually contribute to a political campaign, but we can't work on a political campaign. We can't express our views openly, particularly when somebody knows that we're in the military on a particular candidate. So there have been a few instances the past year where military personnel have been taken to task. There was I think he might have been a sergeant. I can't remember now, but he was at a Ron Paul event earlier this year, and he spoke. He was in uniform, and he spoke at the podium that election night. So, you know, there are restrictions that we have, and there are very good reasons for doing so.
Oh, absolutely, and I just couldn't resist making that comment. And, you know, as when I was a civil servant and I was a federal officer for 30 years, the Hatch Act very much limited us the same way.
Yeah.
So
I
certainly relate to the limitations, but I'll make the point. You can sit there and laugh or not listen. It's okay. But I always like to remind people that it was built on landfill, and I sometimes think it appropriate, having done a bunch of congressional hearings. I just wish that they would hold some listenings once in a while for a change. But certainly I think that the service that you provided while being on the Hill had to be helpful to you as well as to them. And again, this comes back with the need to have familiarity with how our government works. I think far too many Americans are more fascinated about who's going to win the World Series this year, or Dancing with the Stars, or who's going to wind up in the Super Bowl. Politics is boring, can be. And we all have certain negative feelings about the mudslinging that goes on with the political campaigns. And a while back when Anthony Weiner, my congressman, had to leave because he lived up to his name, I had people ask me about whether I was interested in running for Congress, and I said, thank you, but I think I tend to run from Congress rather than for Congress.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly...
You know, Mike, could I take issue with something you said earlier?
Sure.
There was
be my guest.
That...
This is... The First Amendment protects both of us. Go for
Excellent.
It.
You said that politics is boring, and I assume to most people. I would actually argue, and again, I'm putting on my hat from my previous life as a political science instructor,
yes.
and having worked on campaigns, that it's not politics that may necessarily be boring. It's the policies. Because,
yes.
look, I watch C-SPAN. I'll be the first to admit it. I love C-SPAN because I get to get informed, lengthy pieces about policies if I want to. I can throw on, you know, the Senate debates, such as they are, and try to get some more information. If you look at the whether it's MSNBC or Fox or any of the cable networks, CNN, if you're looking at them after midterm elections or debates, those are politics, and that is what gets people emotionally charged and interested. So I think it's actually the policies and the decision making that goes behind those policies, and I think that's why sometimes historically senators have been at a slight disadvantage in in running for higher office, for example, because they are thinking more like the policymakers in the lengthy process in the Senate or the House if they're from there, rather than the more immediate politics.
Well,
and that's
my
personal view based on some experience.
Well, no, I'm a news junkie also, and having done hearings and being involved on a routine basis with a number of the subcommittees on the Hill, I'm very much involved, and I don't find it boring at all. But I think most Americans do, because it requires a little bit extra thought process sometimes. I watch Jay Leno rarely, but on those occasions when I've seen him do jaywalking, I just found it amazing that they were showing photographs. I don't think Leno did this with his jaywalking. It may have been Fox, where they showed photographs of Justin Bieber versus John Boehner. And everybody that they stopped knew who Bieber was, but only a handful of people could identify John Boehner, who, of course, is the Speaker in the House. And you look at this, and
the United States, yeah.
And you say to yourself, well, how is that possible? They couldn't identify Nancy Pelosi.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't able to identify Joe Biden. I mean, this is kind of scary because, you know, when you think about the awesome sacrifices of our men and women in the military, and I would add to that, by the way, the men and women in law enforcement, the federal agents, the police officers,
we're
all putting our lives on the line in support of and defense of our Constitution and this great republic. And then you see people who are so cavalier about it as to not even think that any kind of awareness about this government of ours is worthy of their time or effort, it's kind of disturbing to me. One of the thoughts I had, and you probably won't want to comment, but it's a thought for my listeners. We see maybe you could comment. I don't know. You'll have to be the judge of this one. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we see these great speeches that they make, and it's hard to hold these folks to what they say. It's not like you buy a refrigerator that doesn't work and you bring it back. They promise you the sun, the moon, and the stars and don't deliver. And one day sitting around with some folks on the Hill, I said, you know, wouldn't it be interesting if they required that a politician on the stump would have to either sign an affidavit under the penalty of perjury that he or she actually wrote the speech, or at least tell you who did, the way they run the credits after a Hollywood movie, so at least you get to know whose words they are speaking if it's so hard to keep people to their word in the first place. But again, I think this is something that more Americans should be involved with, to make politicians understand that at the end of the day they will be made accountable for the things that they do and don't do and the things they say and don't follow up on. And that's the work Americans really need to be doing. And unfortunately, I don't think nearly enough Americans are that engaged in the process. And I think we're all paying a price for that lack of commitment on the part of our fellow citizens.
I understand. Not particularly, but I think historically you'll find that, you can generally find out who the speech writers are, either for the president. I mean, when Reagan and George H.W. Bush were president, you had Peggy Noonan. But you can find out pretty easily who the speech writers are for any president, or in many cases you can find out for members on the Hill as well.
Yeah, I would just like to have it a little bit more readily available, just so that people would get an idea. I always think back to Lincoln with the Gettysburg Address, purportedly, that he wrote on the back of an envelope while on a train.
Yeah.
And these were his words. And, that's very inspiring to think that, here was the guy that became the president of the United States who actually spoke his own words.
Yes, and again, I'm going to counter that with, the fact that they are speaking those words, chances are the speechwriters work very closely with the whether it's the member, the senator, or the president. So the speechwriter gets to learn what the policies are, what the issues are, how a particular individual they work for speaks and thinks. So I've written speeches for certainly one of the senators I worked for, but it would be completely marked up after I presented it, but I already knew some of the themes, and I kind of had an educated basis for writing some of the things. But nothing, they don't say anything that is necessarily just handed. They really do read this stuff before they do anything.
Well, that, isn't that ironic? I didn't even realize that you had done that as well. Add that to your list of accolades.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, that was just part of my duties. I was the a national security fellow for a senator from my home state on the Senate Armed Services Committee. So in the course of my duties, you know, I did read a few speeches with regard to national security. So
boy, we're really hitting close to home then. So there. That's interesting. And it's an interesting perspective that you're providing, which is what makes you such a great guest in part. The other part, of course, are the books. And why don't we talk a little bit about what you've written?
Sure. Well, I've written a bunch of articles. I've probably written 30 or 40 articles now for the Christian Science Monitor, the Washington Times, the Forbes.com, Naval History, Vietnam Magazine, and a few others. My books, I started, my first book was a nonfiction book called A Call to the Sea, Captain Charles Stewart of the USS Constitution. That was a naval history book, a biography of the naval officer who probably had the longest career in the U.S. Navy from 1798 to 1860. So that was he was a really fascinating subject. The second book I co-wrote was with one of my colleagues in the political science department. It's called Congress, Games and Strategies. And it's a college textbook on Congress. The third one came out earlier this year, and it was really a culmination of work I had been doing in articles over the past 4 or 5 years. And that one was called Maritime Private Security, and it's about how the private sector has responded to piracy, terrorism, and other 21st century security challenges at sea. So that was also co-edited. And then my most recent book, which is coming out on Monday officially, but people have already been receiving it through Amazon, is called The Aden Effect. It's A-D-E-N. This is my name only on the book, so I'm responsible for anything said in it. And it is my first novel. And the basic storyline is that we find a disgraced former naval officer turned mercenary who has been recalled to active duty to serve as the defense attaché in Yemen to the ambassador as Somali pirates are attacking oil platforms in the Gulf of Aden, and there's an attempted coup in Yemen. And it's kind of interesting because one of the first chapters, we start to see the thinking of the new ambassador, and she's complaining about how she keeps asking Washington for more security and more security. And this is, again, it's a work of fiction. I started writing it a few years ago.
Happened in Libya. And now, of course, the RSO in Yemen was just killed also.
Was it the RSO or was it a Yemeni security official?
The way I had seen it, maybe you're right and I'm wrong. I know I had seen the blurb on it. I had the sense that it was a State Department, but
I think unless I'm mistaken, I thought I read it was a Yemeni security official who was on a drive-by, but I may be mistaken on that. So maybe one of your listeners will correct me. But it deals with some of the subjects that I've been interested in the past decade, and that's piracy. There's a maritime security company involved. There's some foreign policy and how foreign policy is implemented by several different viewpoints from the characters. And there is a U.S. Navy cruiser involved, and I'll leave the Navy cruiser at that for a bit.
But you know,
see that on the cover of the book too.
You know, it's interesting, and we talked about this earlier today when we chatted after Charles Heller, who good friend, great broadcaster. I know you've known him for a long time. He's a real good guy. Gave him a scenic tour of New York, and I think he decided he wanted to get back to Arizona. But I love New York; it's home for me. But you know, it's just kind of remarkable that you were with ONI, and I had worked with the Office of Naval Intelligence back in the late 70s, early 80s, because we found that we had a number of illegal aliens coming into the United States, both from Panama and Jamaica. The Jamaicans, in fact, this is interesting, we always hear about how we need more farm workers, and we don't police the system. So we had so many of these guys who would get visas ostensibly to work in the orange groves of Florida or the apple orchards of upstate New York. They never showed up on the farm, or if they did, they lasted 3 or 4 days and took off, got involved with a different cash crop, unfortunately an illegal cash crop, marijuana, and then ultimately cocaine, were involved in violence and shootings. And some of these guys then branched out and joined the Marine Corps, by acquiring false identity documents, in some cases working with recruiters who were being pressured heavily to meet their recruiting quotas, and then wound up getting weapons training. Some of them went AWOL, some waited till they were mustered out, and used weapons that they had stolen and the training that they had received to hold commando-style bank robberies in the New York City area something like 30, 35 years ago. And I wound up working with ONI and ATF and the New York City Police Department in tracking some of these thugs down. And I will tell you, it was a delight to work with all of the above, and ONI certainly were amazing to work with. I don't have to tell you that you're part of an amazing organization and, or have been part of an amazing organization.
Thanks, absolutely. I was very fortunate to work with them, and you know, who knows what's in store for the future, but I was very fortunate to work with that organization.
And, yeah, and, well, as I say, you've kind of taken the scenic tour. I guess we've both taken the scenic tour, different career paths. But, you know, I think that the more that you see and the more that you see the various components and the way that things interact with one another, the better the picture that you're able to come up with. I'm sure that that helped you to write an effective novel. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm sure that it contributed to your ability to write a novel that although it's fiction, is grounded with some serious facts as well.
Yeah, and I try to keep it as reality-based as possible. I mean, certainly there are going to be instances in any novel where the reader has to suspend belief. And I actually put that in the acknowledgments at the end of the book just to let them know, like, the surface warfare community, I didn't want to insult them by insinuating that just anybody could take command of a U.S. Navy cruiser. But in the course of the book toward the end, there is a particular character who ends up taking over the ship. But it was just to tell the story. And that's, you know, sometimes you have to do that. So I really did try to speak to the experts, whether it's firearms experts. I worked a lot with the helicopter community when I was deployed, and so I spoke to them a lot about, well, what would an SH-60, a Seahawk, do in this instance? How would it operate? What are your options? And whenever I spoke to them or the surface warfare officers, I always made it sure to say, look, obviously I want to be careful about OPSEC, it's operational security.
Right.
And I always ran it by several people, say, look, please give me a sanity check. I want to make sure that there's nothing here. You know, so that's why, it's a fiction book, and so, tried to keep as much of it as reality-based as possible, especially with some of the places that these characters go. I mean, I have never stepped foot in Yemen. I nearly did, but I was close to it. I was supposed to go over there as a special correspondent for a newspaper about almost 4 years ago. But I did spoke with Yemenis. I spoke with other personnel who were involved in the region just to get a better sense, and just simply did a lot of reading to make myself familiar with the history of the country, of the region. And, you know, it's amazing what else is available out there. You know, just using something like Google Earth to give yourself a picture of a place and say, okay, this can't happen because. So I'll make sure that there's a little bit more reality here. So,
well, you know, I was always a science bug. And, in fact, when I was a kid, I got letters from Alan Shepard and Gus Grissom, and I met some of the astronauts. Mm-hmm. Those were the guys I really looked up to.
Wow.
I've always been into aviation and science fiction. But science fiction that didn't get based on some reasonable facts always turned me off. My favorite author, and I had the privilege of meeting him, he's no longer with us, was Arthur C. Clarke. In 2001 was one of the great films of all time, because he was careful to do the best he could to use the best scientific information so that even though it was science fiction, it was grounded with science fact.
Right.
And
in fact,
it was interesting, there's this one scene, if you saw 2001, where one of the astronauts, Dave, has no helmet, and he winds up getting shot back into the spacecraft without the helmet. He's exposed to a vacuum. They weren't going to allow that to go in the film because they were questioning whether it could actually happen, and apparently a test subject was inadvertently exposed to a vacuum and survived it, and it was at that point that they said, okay, we can do that because we know that somebody survived that.
Right.
So, you know, when you're watching that kind of movie or reading that kind of a book, whether it's science fiction or political fiction or military fiction in your case, knowing that you're paying that kind of attention to detail to make it as plausible and realistic as possible, I think that that's really important. So that's all the more reason to make that book something that will wind up on my must-read list.
Thanks,
but I think that's really important. Not that, you know, some fantasy thing
sure.
where you say, well, this could never happen. Well, if it could never happen, why we bother wasting time reading it? So, you know, you want to know that.
Yeah, I've always been wary of people who say, who also say never. You know, I think you probably saw that in intelligence community. I may or may not have heard that once or twice about, well, no, they would never do that. Well, sometimes people do that. And you have to be willing to be a little flexible in your concepts, as you said earlier on with regard to Einstein, and with your analysis, and you have to broaden your perspectives.
Well, but, you know, this is really funny that you're mentioning that, because I've made this point frequently. If you could take a transcript of people standing on a street corner and having a conversation, just by looking at the words without being able to see or see the faces or hear the voices, you could tell if you were dealing with younger people or older people, I think. And here's my metric. You tell me if you agree. Young kids, younger people, are very quick to use the absolutes. Impossible, always, never, so on and so forth. The older people get, the more measured they are and the more likely they are to say, well, this isn't likely or it's not probable rather than impossible. I think that life teaches us that the absolutes should be shied away from wherever possible.
I think it does. You know, that's something I need to consider because I'm actually working on my doctoral dissertation right now as well. And it's about...
In what area, may I ask?
It's in military. It's in naval history. I'm studying Andrew Jackson's Navy, the Navy of the 1830s.
Okay.
And there's a great difference between the older officers, the officers who came in during the quasi-war of 1798, and they're still captains in the 1830s, and they're having these very, very outspoken differences in these early naval magazines with the junior officers. And what's interesting is that they are saying, well, no, we'll never go this way. But that's really interesting. I'm going to have to check it and see how often do they use these absolutist words or not.
I'm glad I can give you something to think about.
Thanks.
Not a problem.
Yeah, don't tell my advisor, okay?
I won't tell your advisor. Your secret is safe. And, you know, you were talking about a sanity check. Having worked for the government for 30 years, I couldn't pass the sanity check anymore, I don't think. Oh, my gosh. You know, what can I tell you? But, you know, I just find this fascinating. What drew you to the Navy in the first place?
It's funny. When I was growing up, I always was reading naval history books. And when I got out of college, I was in graduate school in Boston. And this was 1989, and I was just about to get my M.A., and we were just doing a drawdown, so I'd gone to the recruiter in Boston, and he said, you know, we've got you passed through all the tests, but the bad news is we're doing a drawdown. It could be a year, year and a half before we get you down to OCS, Officer Candidate School. And, of course, when you're, you know, 23, 24, that's sometimes an eternity away.
I was just going to say,
So I figured, okay, well, look, this isn't in the cards. And I ended up doing some other things, and so I guess 7 or 8 years later, I came across an acquaintance up in New England who happened to be a Navy reservist, and he was in the intelligence community, and we started chatting, and I figured, well, look, you know, it's the mid-90s, nothing's going on, but you know what, I'd like to serve somehow, so maybe I'll do it in the reserves. And so it took a couple of years, and finally, you know, I was just determined to get my commission, and I got my commission, and at one point I was working for a company and had been doing pretty well the last couple of years that I was there, and decided I was going to leave and take a 6-month assignment overseas, volunteered for it, and just because I wanted to learn, I wanted to contribute. Financially, I was fine. I just wanted to, you know, work for my country in some way, shape, or form. And when I came back, I was on 2 weeks of reserve duty. I happened to be at the Office of Naval Intelligence, and we were watching on a very beautiful morning the video teleconference with our folks in the Pentagon, And I remember at one point, Commander Schanhauer, who was the lead briefer, said, "Hey, Admiral, we've got to turn over to New York. Something's going on." And that sort of changed perspectives from a lot of cases. I know you're from New York. I'm sure a lot of your listeners are from New York and have a certainly very personal experience with that, as did we here who were either at one of the facilities here in Washington or as I was driving home later that night toward my house, which was near the Pentagon. And since then, I've just spent a little bit more time on active duty than not, and I haven't looked back. It's been a great experience. I've loved every assignment I've had in the Navy, and it's been a great way for me to be able to give back to the country, which has given my family so much.
Yeah, and well, you know, what can I say? And I know how you're going to react, but I really do appreciate your service, and I certainly understand what motivated you, you know. And for me, it was a turning point as well as a New Yorker to see the ashes literally land on my house, to see my neighbors out wandering in the street that night, crying, sitting on the sidewalk in front of my house. They didn't know where their wives or children or parents or siblings or best friends were. And then to see the emergency workers, we talked about this
prepare.
At St. Vincent's Hospital, where my first wife had died of breast cancer, and to see those emergency people, the surgeons and the nurses, the trauma people, waiting for the victims who never showed up, and I made a decision that I needed to go to Congress. I was provided an opportunity initially by Tom Tancredo, who at the time chaired the Immigration House Subcommittee, the Immigration Reform Caucus, rather, in the House, and then Lamar Smith, Jim Sensenbrenner, John Hostetler. Goodness, I can go on forever about all the various hearings that I testified before, because I just felt that it was important to stand up. And you know, that's what's, I think, lacking, is that too many people lack the intestinal fortitude to stand up and confront people that they disagree with, to be good Americans and say, look, I disagree with you, and that's my right as an American. We run too quickly from accusations. You know, if you want to make somebody run away, call them racist, which seems to be what happens with the immigration debate, and it's not about racism. You know, I love living in New York City. It's probably the most ethnically diverse city in the United States, if not the world. I wouldn't want to live anywhere else for me personally. I love the diversity. But we need to know who we're letting into the country. And I compare the immigration issue, the one that I'm intimately familiar with a responsible homeowner or apartment renter who looks through the peephole before admitting a stranger into his or her home. You know, you don't leave your door wide open at night, especially when you've been warned that there are criminals wandering in the neighborhood. We know that America is in the sights of terrorists. We listened to the debate the other day, and you may not be able to comment on that, so I will understand if you don't. But they got into this discussion last night, Joe Biden and Mr. Ryan, Paul Ryan, and they were talking about the threat posed by Iran and the nuclear weapons. Well, what wasn't discussed, and I wish that Paul Ryan had raised the point, was that by not securing the southern border, we know that there are Iranian shock troops in growing numbers stationed in Venezuela. This was the subject of a Pentagon report in 2010. There was an article in the Washington Times subsequent to that. So if you know if Iran is stationing their people there, and Paul Ryan did talk about the attempt to kill the Saudi ambassador by the Quds, the shock troops, and that's who they're sending to Venezuela, then we need to be mindful as to why they're sending soldiers to Venezuela, and I don't think it's a vacation or R&R. So we're leaving ourselves vulnerable in so many ways, in my judgment, by not securing the borders, by not enforcing immigration laws, by providing aliens with identity documents even when we're unable to ascertain who they really are, which was why, I don't know if you saw it or not, but I wrote a commentary for the Washington Times about 5 years ago when comprehensive immigration reform was the hot issue. Senator Sessions liked it so much he quoted me from the floor of the Senate a couple of times during the floor debate, where I came to call comprehensive immigration reform the Terrorist Assistance and Facilitation Act. Not because I'm anti-immigrant. God knows, as an immigration agent, I admitted people into this country. As a high school kid, college kid, I demonstrated in Washington to ask then-President Johnson to let Russians leave Russia who wanted to practice their respective religions, whether it was Judaism, Christianity, didn't matter. It was about providing religious freedom, and I was thrilled as an inspector to admit refugees into the United States and hoped that maybe in some small way the demonstrations and the other things that we had done back when I was in high school and college contributed to Russia's willingness to make that possible. So this isn't about keeping people simply out of the United States, but about being careful as to who we let in, especially as we live in this very perilous world where we worry about the Mexican cartels, other transnational gangs, and terrorists entering the United States and posing a very, to use the phrase, clear and present danger to the security and safety of the United States and our citizens.
Well, for obvious reasons, as you mentioned, I can't comment on current policies. But again, from a historical standpoint, I would agree that border protection is important, as we saw with the Millennial Plot, who was Ahmed Rassam in, was it 2000? I'm trying to think. This is now 12 years ago.
2000 came across the border in the Pacific Northwest.
In Port Angeles? Yeah,
I believe it was.
He came across. In fact, I remember visiting. I just happened to be there a few years ago, and it was Port Angeles, I think it was, or it was right around. It was the ferry over. But again, we see this time and time again. Not only from you mentioned the southern border, but people tend to forget that a number of things were happening along the northern border. That, of course, a dozen years ago with Rassam. But if you look, four decades ago, people don't think of Canada as a hotbed of terrorist activity. But in the 1960s, you had the FLQ, the Liberation Front of Quebec, which was a violent offshoot of the separatist movement at the time, who were terrorists and resulted in the War Measures Act under who was Pierre Trudeau at the time, I think, in 1970. And they were responsible for a number of deaths, explosions, and I think at one point they actually got a van into New York City or were on their way to New York City and were working with some... Yeah, they were working with some locals in New York City and I think they were going to try to bomb the Statue of Liberty or something else.
I believe it was because of the connection to France and so forth. But you know, it's also interesting. There was a story about 3 or 4 years ago how a terrorist in Toronto got a job as a school bus driver. And lots of times terrorists take jobs that give them camouflage and mobility, which is why I get really frustrated when I hear politicians say, well, if we just let the people in that want to work, then the law enforcement can deal with the terrorists. In point of fact, that's the best way to hide in plain sight. The day before a terrorist engages in an attack, he's likely to go to the job, in fact, where he's been hiding in plain sight for months or years. But this guy got a job as a school bus driver and was driving high school boys around, tried to recruit them into a terror cell. The Canadian media contacted me for a statement. And I remember I spoke to the reporter on a Saturday, I believe. The story ran the next day, and Monday or Tuesday that week I started getting phone calls. I was called by the Canadian Senate and the Canadian Embassy, because at the time the issue that was being contested was the requirement for passports or a secure travel document to be used when traveling between the United States and Canada, what was called the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative, WHTI. And so I wound up having a meeting at the Canadian Embassy as a civilian, which was fascinating. I was in Washington for some hearings. I was asked to provide the subcommittee with my thoughts about a hearing in which I was not testifying but sitting in the audience. And then I had a dinner to go to that night in Washington. And I provided a position paper to the Canadian Senate. I guess it did what it was supposed to do, because several months later, WHTI was enacted. So I was thrilled that that did go through, because we really got to be careful about all borders. And that's why I make the point that any state that has a seaport or an international airport or lies on either the northern or southern border must of necessity be considered border states. I don't think you would argue with that perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So, I
agree.
By the way, you talked about in your novel about private response to the pirates, and there's always this debate, and conservatives, and I'm not a political conservative. We may disagree, which is fine. I think disagreement is healthy and can be thought-provoking. We're always hearing about how if we privatize, it will be done better. And then I think about General Motors, and I think about Enron, and I think about Tyco, and I think about AIG, and we can go on. I don't think it's necessarily about privatizing, but it's about getting good leadership, whether it's in government or in the private sector, which sometimes is lacking. But I really think certain missions are better left to the government, law enforcement and military being what I believe is done best by the government. You may disagree. How do you feel about certain functions of the military being contracted out to private contractors? Can you talk about that, or is that an area that's difficult for you?
Well, I won't tell you how I feel about it, but I can tell you what I've seen as I've studied the issue over the past 5 years. And
that would be great.
I didn't focus mostly on the private security companies that we came to know in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Okay.
But again, I want to go historically. Historically, there has almost always been a privatized aspect of military operations. For example, the British farmed out some of their military operations during the American Revolution to Hessian troops. The Americans during the War of 1812, General Andrew Jackson during the Battle of New Orleans, had enlisted the aid of Jean Lafitte and his people. So during both wars, there were privateers. We used to issue letters of marque under the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, and that was that pretty much ended with the 1907, I think, Hague Convention, in which we agreed not to use privately armed ships. But excluding the PSCs in Iraq and Afghanistan, what we've seen emerge in the Gulf of Aden off the coast of Somalia over the past 5 to 7 years, initially you probably had about 6 to 12 armed security companies that provided service to ships. It was pretty rare. Today, because of the necessity, you have over 200, at least 200 companies out there. In any industry, I will say, there are good companies and there are not so reputable companies. I think you and I have seen that there can be somebody who manufactures anything, or, you know, radio talk shows. There are some who are reputable and some maybe perhaps who are not as experienced or reputable. So
absolutely.
I would say any industry, any profession has this aspect of some are better than others. What happens after a while is that the ones who aren't as good are simply going to fall off by the wayside because there is a self-evaluation done within the industry, but with also within the market. We've seen this with private security companies at sea because shipping companies initially were very wary of hiring any kind of armed guard, even just about 5 years ago. But as the shipping companies realized piracy was going up, more ships were being taken, and there simply weren't enough state navies to take care of this particular issue, they had to resort to other means. Part of that was what was called best management practices for the ships. It meant increasing speed at certain times or zigzagging if they saw an approaching skiff. It might have meant putting a barbed wire around the ship to try to prevent Somalis from boarding the craft or the ship. But sometimes it also meant getting armed guards, and there has been a gradual acceptance not only by the shipping companies but by a number of flag states throughout Europe of allowing armed guards aboard ships in order to reduce insurance rates, in order to reduce the incidents. And to their credit, since there has been no ship taken that has had an armed guard aboard. I say that, which we discussed earlier, never say never. It
right,
could
exactly.
happen. There could be a new evolution of Somali piracy, but Somali piracy has pretty much dropped. So what you're starting to see within the private maritime security industry is that daily rates for individual armed guards are dropping. They're looking at other people, not necessarily at former British SAS, their specialized forces who have retired. Now they're looking at potentially other countries who their personnel may not be necessarily as experienced, but they're cheaper. But even within the industry itself, they've tried to provide a self-accreditation. There is an organization, SAMI, S-A-M-I, which evolved a couple of years ago now, to try to give some credibility to the companies. And about 120 companies have now gone through the process where SAMI has provided this accreditation so that the shipping companies know that at least these companies have been vetted through a particular source. So should they or shouldn't they be armed security on ships? That's not for me to say. That's right now, that's up to the private market because they're the ones who were suffering for several years. The private market may see in the next couple of years that piracy has dropped off so much that these private guards are no longer required. certainly there are issues like accountability at sea. What happens if they open fire? What kind of rules are they operating under? What kind of rules of engagement, or as we call it rules of engagement in the military, in the civilian private security sector, they call it use of force. There are certain other rules that they have. So you've seen this interesting evolution of the security industry over the past 5 to 7 years, but it's not something I think that's going to go away necessarily. There are other parts of the world. The Gulf of Guinea is experiencing an incredible increase in the rate of piracy and attacks on oil platforms as well as ships. So it may migrate elsewhere in the world, but as you see countries that simply can't operate their own, you're going to see an outreach to have somebody else. And this was a kind of a strange chapter to have in my last book that came out. But we talked about Sea Shepherd, which is the it was kind of an offshoot of Greenpeace. The founder of Sea Shepherd was originally a Greenpeace member, and they have a show on the Discovery Channel called Whale Wars, which I just follow Whale Wars religiously. I'm fascinated by the show because they don't see themselves like this, but I see them as a maritime security force. They have a particular purpose in protecting whales, dolphins, whatever. But what was interesting, about a year or so ago, they were it looked like they were going to be employed by the island nation of, I think it was Palau, to do fisheries protection. So here you had a non-state actor with several ships, Sea Shepherd, trying to protect the fisheries of this small island nation. So there's a really interesting evolution. So as we see these state navy ships decrease in number, the United States, pick your country in Europe, there's going to be a vacuum on the high seas. Somebody is going to fill that vacuum. And just as you talk so passionately about immigration when there's a vacuum, what happens when there's a vacuum at sea? You're going to see more pirates and other non-state actors, terrorists and others, using the sea because they see that opening.
That's fascinating. And you know, you've provided an insight that I hadn't even contemplated. So that's the advantage of bringing in an expert who really knows the issue as nobody else does. You know, I've really got to get you back on this program, and also for Talk Border. I'd love to do an interview with you there. These issues are of such critical importance, and unfortunately, I don't think that most news programs provide the kind of in-depth and accurate information that you're able to provide in this very important area.
Well, thanks. You know, I think it's just that there are people who spend time focusing on a particular issue, and sometimes these issues emerge, and you're able to talk about them a little bit more. And I have certainly with Charles Heller, and now I've done so with you and some other folks. And certainly, we hope that the book, that third book, helps. And that's why I really wanted to discuss it in part. I wanted to have a maritime security firm in this book, the Aiden Effect, and kind of explore this issue and make people think differently about it, not necessarily to influence them, but to say, hey, this is happening out there. What if XYZ happens?
And this goes back to multiple sides to the issue. It's not always black and white or only one side especially.
That's absolutely true. In fact, when this was October of 07, I think it was, and I had written a Naval War College paper, which became a lengthy article for Orbis, which is the quarterly of the Foreign Policy Research Institute, and I didn't pick this title. My editor picked it. It was called Black Waters for the Blue Waters, the Promise of Private Naval Companies, and I remember after the article came out, I got a call from one of the folks at Blackwater, and they said, hey, you know, it was kind of an interesting article because you laid up both pros and cons, and we understand that, but, you know, we'd like to invite you to see our facility in Moyauk and invite you to see our ship. And that's when I really started to look at this a little more, because the theory had become reality at that point. And, of course, Blackwater no longer exists. There are other companies out there, mostly British companies, which have ships providing some degree of escorts. But, again, that's something I wanted to talk about in the Aiden Effect, and I know we're a couple of minutes out, but I do want to mention that since we talked about
military, we can run a little bit long, by the way. It's not a problem.
Okay, sure. I did want to mention that, you know, I certainly always wanted to serve, and I was very proud to have had the service that I have for the past number of years. But I also wanted to do a little bit more, and that's why for the Aiden Effect, I'm donating a portion of the proceeds to an organization which I learned about 6 months ago. It's called Horses for Heroes. It's a ranch run by a former Green Beret out in New Mexico. And what they do is they help out returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, some have lost an arm or whatever, and they help them just living life on a ranch like a cowboy. And I just think it was the coolest thing I'd ever heard about. And, you know, they're a small organization, and I just wanted to help out in a small way. And so that's in my
What was the name of that organization again? May as well put it out there again.
Sure, it's Horses for Heroes, and you can go to horsesforheroes.org. And I've been in touch a bunch of times with Rick Iannucci, who's the head of it, and I just think it's a great organization, and again, I'm just trying to help out in a small way with a portion of the proceeds of the book.
Do you have your own website also, or just the title of your book, or if people want to know more about?
Actually, sure. If you want to know more about me, my book, my articles, it's claudeberube.com. It's claudeberube.com. And, you know, I'm sure you can put it up on your site too, Mike. So
That's really terrific. I really want to thank you for spending an hour with me this Friday evening. I know you were supposed to have had a book signing. It's funny how things sometimes work out. I hope that signing gets underway within the next couple of days. I know there was a last-minute change in plan, so it really worked out fortuitously for both of us this evening. It's a pleasure to have had you on the program.
Well, thanks. It was certainly my pleasure.
Well, great conversation. You were right. You know, when I spoke with Claude earlier today, folks, he said it's going to be a quick hour, and this has indeed been a very quick hour, and I hope to have you come back and visit again.
Thanks. It'd be an honor. Thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you so much. I wish you a wonderful weekend. I hope the weather is beautiful in Annapolis. I got to tell you, you live in a great part of the country. I've been there to testify before the state legislature, and I've eaten in those restaurants, and it's really a beautiful, unique place. You must be really thrilled to live there.
I am, and I hope we can see you down here sometime.
Absolutely. During maybe one of my next trips to D.C., I've got a couple scheduled. We'll get together, grab a meal.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Folks, I want to thank all of you for spending the past hour with me and my guest. You know, this program is all about providing information that you're not likely to get anywhere else. Again, I'd like for you all to go to my websites. Let me give you the websites again. It's michaelcutler.net. Also, please go to talkborder.com. And finally, I want to remind you, Californians for Population Stabilization, capsweb.org in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara. I thank all of you for listening. I want to remind you, as I always like to say at the end of my commentaries, democracy is not a spectator sport. Please get involved. Pay attention to the presidential debates. Pay attention also to the people that are running for Congress and the Senate, wherever you may live, and also the folks running for local office. If they're supposed to represent you, they need you to tell them how they can best do that. That's the job that we as Americans are all responsible for doing. I thank you so much for joining us this evening, folks. Hope you have a terrific weekend. Look forward to seeing you all next week, same time, same place. So long, everybody. Have a terrific weekend.